Welcome to the Building Science Podcast.
Bringing the human factor to architecture and design.
Brought to you by Positive Energy in Austin, Texas.
Hello and welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to the Building Science Podcast. I'm Christoph Irwin, here solo today as far as the Building Science Podcast staff goes, but I have the great honor to be here with Luke Leung. He's the firm-wide principal for sustainability at Skidmore, Owens & Merrill, also known as SOM. He's also a lead fellow and he's on the board of directors for ASHRAE. So we're really honored to be here. He is also a guitarist and plays with his son.
Yes.
Would you like to introduce yourself a little more in any dimension there?
No, that's fine. That's really good introduction. Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah, glad you're here too. Thank you so much. So we're here. Luke had the idea to start with a letter to teachers of American history, and it was by Henry Adams of Harvard in 1910. So Luke, would you like to start out, read the quote or discuss why you wanted to bring it up and then read it, please?
Sure. I always look back and thought about how could we do things a little differently. And when you look at the carbon emission of the world, it really didn't get too bad. It didn't get too bad until late 1800s, early 1900s. So during that time, I thought it was interesting that Henry Adams from Harvard, he said, "Guys, let's do this. Let's have a letter to all the American teacher of history to let them know that the importance of teaching second law of thermodynamics, the idea of entropy." And here's why. He said, within a finite period of time past, the Earth must have been, and within a finite period of time to come, the Earth must again be unfit for the habitation of man or humans as at present constituted, unless operations have been or are to be performed, which are impossible under the laws to which the nose operations going on at present in the material world are subject. In short, basically, it's saying, at one time, stuffs are not so good. And because of entropy, in the future, it will not be, that will be a time that is also not so good, unless the second law of thermodynamics is different. Guys, when we look at the issue of our built environment today, I always wonder, what if we really listen to Henry Adams at the turn of the century and educate humanity the idea of entropy and why we need to use that at least as a filter to filter the work we do every day.
Yeah, yeah. And just to chime in briefly, as someone who took several philosophy courses in college, this is one sentence, by the way, if I believe there's a period at the end. It's quite a long period of comments. It's really easier to understand when you see it. And even then it's it's as though Henry Adams said, I'm going to write a sentence with as many commas as I can, but it's really an important point. And it basically says, as you just said, unless we expect the laws of physics to change, we need to really think differently about how we deliver habitation to ourselves as beings. And in the context of the planet as a whole, if we had a very low entropy planet, it would say that the climate system would be really stable, predictable weather, right? High entropy means greater variability, greater unpredictability. And so we are moving toward that. And sort of a related term, I guess we're going to start by nerding out about the second law for a little bit, thermodynamic laws, enthalpy, right? Enthalpy is a measure of energy. You know, it's thermal energy and energy in phase changes, like heat and humidity in the atmosphere. So we're also pushing a lot more enthalpy into our atmosphere right now. Right, I've read that every 1 degree Fahrenheit increase in average atmospheric temperature, that's 7% more moisture in the atmosphere, which is 7% less moisture in soil and plants. And so that means more energy in the atmosphere, more dynamism, more powerful storms. And just my last comment is, we're already experiencing some pretty intense storms and fires. And, you know, this is just the opening round, right, in some sense.
Totally, totally. I think there are two things to take away from here. Number one is, look, 100+ years later, as far as we know, the second law of thermodynamics and the physical laws of nature didn't change yet. So I think one question we should have is, what about 100 years from now? What if we start think about the holistic world, at least proportionally in the entropy dimension? That's number one. Number two is, this idea is heavy on engineering. The engineers got to step up in the built environment to talk about this dimension or interpret this dimension into everything we do, because carbon is only one of the entropy measure. There are a whole lot of other things in there. If we don't start using that lens to see the stuff, to see the things we do through that lens, plenty of things to come in another 100 years. Let's not let that happen.
Very, very well said. Yes, and I want to just double down on engineers who are listening, architects who are working with engineers, clients who are wondering what the role is of their engineer. We've entered a place in society, in societal kind of actions, where how a building looks and how a building functions are of equal importance. And so he also mentioned, Luke also mentioned this really important idea that I don't think it gets stressed enough, is that when we talk about carbon, we hear about carbon. Carbon is just one dimension, and it's, and in that sense, it's somewhat of a proxy for other environmental problems. And just kind of stepping into the conversation today, Luke, we're going to be talking about a standard, the life cycle assessment standard, in some sense. I want to take you to the Sun Belt first, but for the introducing the show, we're going to be talking about this European Life Cycle Assessment Standard, EN15978. And it has these phases, the A phases, the B phase, C phases, and even a D phase. But within that standard, they have these things called impact categories. And global warming potential, right, is one of them, right? So that's carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but even not just carbon dioxide. There's methane, nitrous oxide. But then just to run through them quickly, in fact, maybe we could run through them and you could comment. So global warming potential.
Yeah.
Please comment on global warming potential. I'll take you through all of them. Ozone depletion, acidification.
Yeah. I mean, as you know, EN15978 is as simple as A, B, and C. And then there's an optional D. Under A is no matter you do A, B, and C, there's EPD you need to use, and under EPD there are 7 dimensions on land, sea, and air. And inside the dimension of air, one of them is your GWP, your global warming potential, which is your carbon dioxide. Now the world is using GWP of 100 right now, right? But if you go to GWP of 20, for example, then your 410A's GWP will be almost double. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm afraid we're going to have to unpack that a little bit. 100 what and 20 what?
It's 100 years of duration and versus 20 years of duration. And those are the duration that material will be in the air, basically the impact of it.
100%. Yeah. Like if you're in a car and it pulls to the left and you can't control it, it's pulling to the left. Well, you don't care if it pulls to the left beyond shooting you off the road. Once you've gone off the road, that's the problem. So we really need to be focusing on, and maybe that's a terrible metaphor, but we really need to be focusing on carbon emissions now, right? And they last for a long time.
Yeah.
And so you also mentioned 410A, that's a refrigerant, and it has a very high GWP relative to carbon, right around 2000, I think.
Yep, 2088, something like that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's GWP. Let's see, I'm going to count these. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Oh my goodness. So there's 9 of these things. Ozone depletion potential. Comment? Any thoughts on that?
I think that one, we got it under control. This is high level of ozones in the atmosphere with the Montreal Protocol. I think that's one time that humanity can celebrate what we can do working together, right? We kind of minimize, if not eliminate, the ozone problem at one time with this big hole in the Arctic, but we kind of took care of that. So we should really celebrate that and remember what we can do as humans together. So as we think about that another 100 years, let's celebrate humanity together now, and not just engineers. We've obviously, as you know, I work in an architects and engineering world. So it's about the arts and science together, humanity together, to kind of work towards bigger and better things.
Yeah, well said. I love the idea that the fact that we have impact on the planet is typically connoted as a bad thing, right? Because we're having negative impact. But the fact that we have impact, it also swings the other way. That means we can have positive impact. Okay, so the next one on this list, keep in mind, these are the impact categories. So we're talking about life cycle assessment of buildings, and these are the impact categories that are looking at the various ways the built world and, you know, all the supply chains to it and out downstream effects from it. So we've talked about global warming potential, ozone depletion potential. The next one is acidification potential.
Yeah, that's also highly related to the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and dissolve into the ocean and acidify the ocean, which could have issue with, you know, the shellfish and other issue with the water being more acidic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's sulfur oxides and nitrous oxides. And then eutrophication potential.
So this is the most interesting one, because there are other dimensions, has a lot to do with carbon dioxide, right? If you have high carbon dioxide, chances are you're going to have more acidic ocean. And if you have
raining.
Right. But eutrophication is different. It's a different sort of animal. Now, oftentimes in the built environment today, people say, oh, let's go to biogenic material. It may not be the answer if the biogenic material is creating more runoff of nutrients, especially phosphate and nitrogen, because those nutrients will wash into the ocean and create algae bloom. And when the algae die, it suffocates the seafood. Eutrophication happening all over the world. So as we like jump into that biogenic story, let's make sure we must regenerate our land through regenerative farming and take care of eutrophication. So that is one key component that as we go towards biogenic material, let's not forget eutrophication.
Yep, well said. Yeah. So think about the mouth of the Mississippi here in the U.S. and just the massive algal blooms that are, you know, larger than many, many of the smaller states.
Because another 40, 50 years from now, when the world have 10 billion people, food, including seafood, will be the next big issue if we don't take care of the entropies.
Yeah, I love that you're bringing entropy into it. So what you know, the entropy comes in as it's more energy, more dynamism, more unpredictability, more variability. You know, these, just like the human body has all these systems that work together and are set up to, when they work a certain way, we call that health. And when they don't, we call that disease or dis-ease. Okay, so very good on eutrophication. I feel like I'm quizzing you, by the way, listeners. He didn't know I was going to go through this list, so it's pretty impressive. So the next one is photochemical ozone creation potential.
That's the near-ground ozone. It has a lot to do with the combustion And if we can take care of the internal combustion engine and minimize a lot of the near ground combustion, then you're not going to see that. I mean, you see that all the time from the fog or the smog in LA to I just came back from India and Pakistan. And, you know, if you've been to those places before, you know what I'm saying in the wintertime. So let's take care of combustion. And if we can get rid of that, we're going to have a lot less issue of this near ground smog in our cities.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I could have mentioned. So, you know, we are living in the fossil fuel era, right? That's what we were born into. That's what we're currently living in. And it's impacting the photochemical ozone production. It's obviously impacting carbon production, but it's also related to those algal blooms in the sense that we use fossil fuel rich materials as fertilizers. And that is a lot of what's running down the Mississippi, you know, and coming out into the Gulf.
And sometimes I wonder at the turn of the centuries, and the turn of the century, 1907, when Henry Ford came up with the idea of cars using fossil fuel, I wonder what if there are some smart engineers start thinking about entropy and said, wait a minute, what about this? And how do we take care of that? Now, that's 1907, but it's also happening today. It's every single decision we make, we kind of have the lens of entropy and filter through it, and also boldly state what we think potentially can happen rather than shy away from the discussion. We need the voice of the engineers that familiar with the entropy to boldly state what may happen into the discussion of this world and not shy away from it. Only irons can sharpen irons.
Oh man, I love that one. Yeah, and it's not just as, I mean, it's older than that, right? 1895, Svante Arrhenius presented to the Stockholm Physical Society about what he saw as the long-term impact of fossil fuels into the atmosphere. And, you know, 1895, and we're largely following his graphs from then, right? And yet there are still people that are like, well, it's not for sure. Could be just natural cycles. It's pretty clear that there's other forces at work besides physicists and engineers. There's some propaganda and messaging out there. There's four more. Abiotic depletion potential, ADP.
Yeah, that's basically land resources that get depleted. Now, on that note, the module D is important. Circular economy. Some of you know that if you are architects, if you are in the green guru communication, you have seen a lot of the circular economy discussion in terms of who are the manufacturers can provide recycled product, buyback program, and all that stuff. And the recent discussion about how do we recycle hard hats, right? If you are engineers, now think about SIPSI, UK. They developed TM66, one of the first documents from engineers who talk about circular economy in lighting fixture. Guys, let's leapfrog the process. If you are engineer, start think about circular economy and drive that discussion, because this will be coming.
Absolutely. It's coming fast. I guess we need you to unpack the SIPSI. Do you happen to remember what it stands for?
It's the S-Ray of UK. That's how I remember it.
That's a better way to say it. Yeah. Okay. So we also mentioned in that little definition there, he went back again to the modules, and just listening, you really don't need to dig into it too much, right? There's A, B, C, D, and it's really mainly A, B, C, which is a little bit unfortunate that we don't focus on D, but this is the life cycle assessment standard. And A is basically cause the product to exist and put it in your building. A1 to 3 are put it, you know, is cause it to exist, and A4 and 5 are transport it and install it. And then B is it's in the building and you're using it. And so a lot of the B emissions are operational emissions. And then C is this cradle to cradle kind of idea, or cradle to grave, at least. You know, it's end of life stage. It's deconstruction. Our buildings made to be deconstructed, and then there's transporting it, and there's waste disposal and disposal. And then there's D, which is often forgotten, which is, you know, fundamentally it's Earth's geobiosphere that is processing our chemical wastes and our thermal wastes.
Yeah. Now I wanna add two things to that. Number one is out of A, B, C, D module, A, B, C in general are always in positive number, meaning it contributes to emissions. Only module D is negative. I don't have to tell you, if you are engineers listening, you need that negative number to be huge, to be zero. That's why circular economy has to be the future in order to have the accounting get to zero, number one. Number two is module B. Now, starting end of last year in 2023, there's at least from RICS RICS from UK, module B has B8. What is B8? The user contribution to emission that include your transportation back and forth to the building. And for this discussion, more interesting is the emission of other GHG. What do I mean by that? Let's say if you have a 10 kV transformer and the insulation is SF6, right? It can also leak, not a refrigerant, but it also...
That's sodium hexafluoride.
That's right. And it can also leak. And its GWP is the range of 20 plus 1,000, right? So that if that stuff start leaking, you got to account for it. It's not a refrigerant leakage, but that's something that you have to account for it. You have medical gases, right? Those are not refrigerant, but those become part of that process of the building. It becomes B8 because it doesn't come with the building, the medical gas, but during the operation, you're going to release them. So the B8 allows you to account for these sort of things. And finally, B8 also allows you to account for, if I buy paper, it has embodied carbon, right? That's kind of that B8 category. So start thinking about that. Starting in RICS, not exactly in EN15978 yet, but as you can imagine, that probably will be coming.
Yeah. Do you remember how you described it? B8, the title of that module? Or
it's basically the user's emissions. Yeah, like if you know, the tenants going back and forth, like what the users are doing.
And so just to round it out, B is the use stage, and B1 to 7 are more normal. I hadn't heard of B8 before. So B1 is use, B2 is maintenance, B3 is repair, 4 is refurbishment, which is different from repair. It's expected. B5 is replacement. B6 is operational energy. That's the main one we talk about or think about. And B7 is huge. Also, it's operational water. Potable water is a very highly embodied energy material. And now B8, I'm very pleased to hear user emissions. Fantastic.
So like if you think about the proportion of this stuff, right? We just did a recent study using my company as an example. If you look at the emission of a typical office building, assuming the traffic pattern of my company, the BX number on transportation alone is almost 40-50% of the whole life carbon pie. So it's a big number. Yeah, it's a big number. Including operational energy of the building, including everything. Once you include the transportation energy or the transportation emission of the people going back and forth, that's a big part of the pie.
I just want to dig into that and make sure I'm tracking. Are you saying that the way LCA is currently conducted with B1 to 7, excluding B8, ignores this roughly 40% contribution generally?
Yeah,
Wow.
Now, that's just my building as an example. It varies, right? Obviously, depending on how you travel and all that stuff. But the transportation number is not going to be a small one.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. And let's also put it in context. Luke is in a major American city that has public transportation.
Yeah, right? Chicago is kind of not so nice because there's quite a bit of car traffic involved. It's not like Hong Kong and Singapore, but yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you have light rail.
Yeah, we have light rail. I take the train every day to work, but not everybody can do that. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just saying, here I am in Austin, Texas, and we have just such a token light rail. And, you know, interestingly, every time it comes up on a ballot initiative, it passes that I know of, you know. Okay, so there's three more. This is great. We're going through them and we're kind of elaborating while we go through. So there's three more. The next one is marine aquatic ecotoxicity.
So I think that's pretty much what it is. It's basically the seawater, how toxic it is to get to the marine animals.
Mm-hmm. And is that related to the destruction or the collapse of coral reefs, or is it a different one in here?
I thought it's more related to the acidification of the ocean.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I was wondering too, the acidification potential. Yeah, yeah, because it's limestone. Yeah. Okay, good. So there's two more. Then human toxicity potential. Great.
Okay, I think we know kind of what we did. I mean, there's, I am a citizen of U.S., but I am also a PR of Canada. I mean, you look at a satellite picture of the amount of chemicals that go into the Great Lakes. You can actually see a plume of chemical from the American side, but not so much on the Canadian side, because the way they treat the lawn, they are not allowing any sort of chemical to do it in Ontario. So, yeah.
Man, I love this, and it's disheartening, right? Yeah, like I mean, I don't know if anyone listening, if you haven't looked into the invention of the American lawn, boy, were we sold that, and it's deep in our psychology, not to mention the invention of the American suburb. So these were, you know, roughly speaking, you could say these were by industry, for-profit market transitions, and they've gotten deep into our psychology. Okay, so the last one, and it's kind of very similar. So we had the last three were marine aquatic ecotoxicity, human toxicity potential, which, by the way, a major vector of pollutants into our body is through our breath, through our breathing, because we don't, like, unlike eating, our breathing doesn't have any sort of nutrient waste discrimination function. We just breathe. But the last one is ecological toxicity potential.
Yeah, that one, so actually, I would need some help on this one. Do you know what that is?
Well, it's very similar. It's almost like it's the broad category. It's the first one was saying the oceans. The second one, it was saying the building, the air, the space inside the building can be delivering toxins. And the last one is talking about toxic effects on ecosystems, right? These are chemical potentials. You know, in fact, there's a whole nother, and I promise not to devolve, but there's the Stockholm Resilience Center has their nine planetary boundaries, and their number nine is, they call it novel entities, which I'm disappointed. And it basically is chemical pollutant loads. So we're going to be talking to the Healthy Building Network people about that one. Okay, good. So we've started out by unpacking a bit of the ABCD sections of the EN15978 standard. They really should think of another name for it. It's basically the LCA standard, life cycle assessment standard. And in there, we went through the impact categories associated with buildings. And then external to all this life cycle assessment analysis is that things are accelerating sometimes in ways that we don't see. So, you know, this idea that now is the time to really lean into your engineer and your physicist and really lean into your buildings. And Luke, you did this fantastic study. You led me through it, this analysis of the Sun Belt. you know, population growth in the Sun Belt. Please, could you describe this?
Yeah, I don't think we need to dive into deep numbers. I think we are now, if you are with us so far, what do we talk about? We talk about 100 years ago, what happened, and 100 plus years later, what we can do, number one. Number yes. two, we talk about this whole life carbon thing, right? So what can we do now? Well, here's what we can do now. Looking into the future, we know population demographics going to grow. But as HVAC engineers, let me tell you this. The projection is today we have 2 billion pieces of AC equipment. 2 billion pieces of AC equipment for roughly about 8 billion people. Okay? Fast forward 30, 40 years. What's going to happen? Do you know? 10 billion people, because they got richer and they're going to move south, which is in US is the Sun Belt. It's not going to be the Chicago, which I'm in. It's not going to be those northern cities. It's going to be the growth in the southern city. And as a result, the demand in AC and in the whole world, there's this global south. The Indians, the Pakistan, population growing, South America, yeah. China. And as a result, the global demand on AC equipment will rise from 2 billion now to about 6 billion by the year 2050 to 2060. So we are actually in a critical point of human history as HVAC engineers to make a difference, just like 100 plus years ago, to create a better world, because they're going to demand a lot of AC, and it's up to us, using the idea of entropy and whole life carbon, to minimize the whole life carbon and using that EPD parameter and run this whole life study beyond carbon to get to a no entropy world 50 to 100 years from now, so we can make people cool and also create a better planet and also regenerate the land, our air, our water, to make human healthier. That is on our shoulder. We got our work cut out right in front of us.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I think we're entering a phase of cultural change, or the necessity of cultural change is actually somewhat dissonant with us in terms of our personalities, our psychology, because we haven't lived through this before.
Yeah. And also as North American engineers, well, let's be careful. The Yeezy mentality is we're going to walk into the global south. We're going to go to Sun Belt and say, let me tell you what you need to do. Well, guess what? When I went to Africa, the local engineers, the first thing, you know, what he told me was, you know, you guys got the terms funny. I said, why? You know, you call yourself HVAC engineer. He said, do you know in Africa, we really don't have any heating. We only has VAC. So like, don't think that, I guess the point here is, guys, let's listen and be careful with the attitude of going into this world and start saying, let me tell you what you need to do. That may not be the way they want it.
That's beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. Listen first. First seek to understand, then communicate. Yeah. We often start with, let me tell you my beautiful thoughts. They're so important. I can't wait to share them with you. But yeah, so, you know, just to put an underscore what Luke just said with this rise of the global south, which I misunderstood it as Sun Belt. Sun Belt is really a term for the southern United States.
Yes.
But there's a global Sun Belt is what you're referring to.
That's a global south, or you can call it global Sun Belt, basically on the south side of the earth. Not so much the Chicago, the London, the New York, not those traditional cities in the north.
Yeah. And so the population is going to go from roughly 8 billion to roughly 10 billion. So you could call that 20% growth.
Yeah. And also, as many of you know that, like, if you Google or look at the, you know, the top most populated city around the world in the next, you know, 30 years, many, many of the cities are names that you may not even heard of.
Yeah. And they're not in the US. There are very few of them. Actually, I don't know if many of them are.
But in order for us to have an impact and also learn from each other, if this is the growth pattern, we may want to start understand what do they need? What are their voices, right? Because, you know, this could be a win-win situation for all, and also could be just simply good business for some of us.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I really like that. I really love that theme of listening to the world instead of talking to it, especially coming from the United States culture and industry. I mean, we're like 350 million people out of 8 billion. Yeah, just to underscore that. So the 8 billion is going to 10, that's 20% increase, but the units of HVAC are going from 2 billion to 6 billion, 300% increase.
And there's something we can learn, right? What we can learn. If you go to those countries today, they have adaptive comfort. Well, what do we do in the North, and especially in North America? Even today, many buildings are basically glass boxes.
Yeah.
And what happened to adaptive comfort? What happened to the microbial and the diversity of microbial that keeping human healthy? Do we truly believe that if we have a glass box and we put any sort of animals or species inside there, they will be truly living healthier? Not necessarily longer. I think they will live longer because you put them away from their natural enemies and natural weather elements, right? So they potentially can live longer. But all the studies indicate if you put any sort of animals in a confined environment, they live longer, but they're going to develop chronic diseases. In a way, it's very much like human beings. You know, we as Americans, our life expectancy, it increased from, you know, 40 years ago in the 1800s to, well, recently we decreased a little bit, but still we are close to 80 years old, right? Almost double, right? So we live long. But when you look at the chronic diseases, it's really hurting us in terms of our healthcare. Think about the, you know, diabetes, right? The asthma, allergy. We have people allergic to chicken in our office. How do they get through the evolution?
Yeah, and boy, we could spin this out lots of different directions. I mean, we're constantly exposed to materials. I mean, even just go back to air quality. We take it into our blood and our immune system doesn't understand it. And we start to develop inflammatory responses and autoimmune responses and our body.
I think so. I think we need to kind of think about as we, you know, work with different regions, we really need to think through it in the lens of entropy. Maybe there's something about adaptive comfort. Maybe there's something basic about this interaction with nature that we need to learn from them rather than putting a glass box in those countries and thinking that's the solution to have a better life.
I'm loving this interview. I did not know how cool this was going to be. Just a couple of related comments. One, yes, I just this idea to measure quantity and not quality is pervasive, right? So we're measuring lifespan instead of health span, or you could even say joy span, right? That's what you want. You want to get some joy out of your life. And taking it into the realm of buildings, right? Like, yeah, I love that you're saying, really, do you think something living in the glass box is having a superior experience? But this idea of just simply idea, these three words together, smaller, better buildings, right? Less quantity, more quality. I really think we need to, we as all you guys listening, it's you and I, Luke, we need to hold that in mind as we go through our own lives and make our decisions when we're talking to family and friends and when we're talking to colleagues and clients.
I think if you think entropy, things will be tend to be more efficient, more compact. Something when you just look at certain things, you just smell it. It's like, oh, that doesn't just smell right. Just look, thinking, smelling. Like if you try to smell for entropy, right? Something you just walk in there, well, wow, that just doesn't smell like low entropy here, guys.
Yeah, I love it. It doesn't pass the sniff test. Total random. One of my neighbors has a lemon tree in their yard growing here in Austin, Texas. And they're giving away lemons. They have the basket by the curb. And I picked one of the lemons and I just scratched it with my thumbnail and smelled it. It smelled so good. Like, I don't know what was going on, but it was like my nose, my body was controlling my nose going, smell more of that. That smells good.
Yeah, actually, that brings up a different point. Is sometimes we control the air we breathe. Certain odor, right? For example, citrus odor usually will bring in kind of make you happy feeling. So
that.
I guess there's a dimension of, you know, on top of PM2.5, on top of VOC content, let's not exceed certain micrograms per cubic meter. Maybe we should also think about, what about the thermal delights? Some of you read that book.
Yeah.
The breathing of certain flower fragrance can remind you of certain garden and certain ways that immediately take you to a place where you feel cool, right? So what are the thermal delights that maybe we have missed by becoming too quantitative as an engineer? What are the qualitative aspects of our, maybe the more the art side of science?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think?
I think we are actually human beings. So our emotion and our feeling does sometimes has its impact on us and make us feel certain ways. So we're going to have to address both the quantitative elements, which we are really good at as engineers, but also start to elevate ourselves out of that to understand how the qualitative stuff can impact us. Is the left and right brain work together to make us a whole human being?
Love it. I love it so much. Yeah, I want to stay with this. I want to quickly point out, he's referring, when he said Thermal Delight, the book, Thermal Delight in Architecture, Lisa Heschong, what a gifted writer, what a gift to all of us that book has been. I'd love to talk to her about it. But, it, you know, basically it was like that, you know, the thermal environment can actually be a delight for us. It can be a benefit. And just I want to underscore that everything we all do, in fact, even more broadly, if you say, you know, I, Christoph Irwin, am having a good life, what I really mean is I'm having a good subjective emotional experience of life, generally positive, which, you know, does mean including bearing the negative cycles with some equanimity. But what we seem to have associated with a good life is longer time on the planet, breathing more, owning more stuff, never having examined whether that's actually creating more positive emotional experience. Mm-hmm. Boy, have we gone into an interesting direction from entropy.
But that's actually very much aligned with some of the S-ray thinking of dynamic thermal comfort. So thermal comfort is not static, but dynamic. The ideas of anesthesia, thermal delight. The idea that maybe there are times you don't need like a constant temperature environment. I think usually in the morgue, they have a constant temperature environment. But if you go to the beach, the wind on your head, the fireplace in a in a cold evening. Those are kind of the thermal delight moment that give life pleasure. And maybe we should try to understand more of how to create this adaptive environment. By the way, which the third world country oftentimes will have more of that sort of thing, that sort of elements, because they may not have the full AC or the full heating indoor. But I think those are the things we can learn from each other and put the science around it to quantify the benefit. But the combination of art and science is gonna make this special evidence-based design.
Yeah. Yeah, and in the context of buildings, right, architecture is both an art and a craft, right? The craft side is where I'd bring the science in. I just want to make sure. So he's talking about alesthesia, and pre-pandemic, we were poised to interview Gail Brager, UC Berkeley, who has been doing this study, basically thermal delight, you know, kind of quantifying it. And I'm really lamenting that I never caught back up with her after the pandemic, but she used this term thermal blandness. And, you know, you're mentioning sort of the strategy that we have as a species to say, you know, what would be the best possible thing would be to house ourselves most of the time in a glass box filled with thermal blandness, 75 degrees, 50% RH. And we never, as you say, evidence-based. Does the evidence bear that out?
Oh, yeah. So like when I was chairing the Environmental Health Committee for ASHRAE, so we start looking at dynamic thermal comfort, because when you look at the human body, our heat generation is not constant. It actually follows some sort of curve throughout the day. So it will make sense based on the amount of heat you generate and adjust the environment accordingly. And also, your body doesn't emit the same amount of heat everywhere, right? So it will make sense to only address the part of the body that generate heat, right? And to cool it down. So I think that this dynamic thermal comfort is actually happening out there. We just need to maybe spend more time to understand that. That's one thing. And the second thing is comfort is environment is not a one size fits all, right? We design lighting level at, you know, 300 lux with ambient light, and then another 200 lux with test light. What age of human we are designing to? Well, 40 years old male or female.
And or what gender, yes. And what are they wearing?
Right. Yes. If you take a guy who's 60 years old, their lighting level they need to read, same performance, is about 1,000 lux. So why are we not designing an environment based on the needs of the person we are working with and dynamically change that to save energy and to actually make it more equitable? Think about the during pandemic times, you know, the older people got hurt the most and maybe death rate is much higher. Shouldn't we design a world that is differently to take care of them so they have less chronic diseases? By the way, this is all still wrapped around the idea of entropy. To minimize the entropy in a way is to keeping people healthy so we don't have to spend that much energy to treat them. So design places that they can see better, they can live better. And it's not a one-size-fits-all. Starting with dynamic comfort, dynamic environment, not a one-size-fits-all. I think there's a lot of things we need to spend more time to understand how do we minimize this entropy we have.
Yeah, and there's just so many directions to take this. But yes, generally speaking, I'm nodding completely that we seem to take a point in time of, you know, let's say our BTUs per hour emissions, and we say, oh, and that's what it is, and not recognize that it varies. And then also on this thermal delight, for me to feel the delight of my home cooling me off, I need to get warm, right? Otherwise, I'm just neutral all the time. And it's like absence of discomfort is not the same as the presence of comfort.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And also the other dimension I think we should start look at is what's comfort mean when you're sleeping? Because S-ray 55 is really defining comfort as a kind of PMV and PPV, right? So you can vote it, like whether it's good or no, and not good. Well, what about when you're sleeping? How do you vote whether you're comfortable or not? You're sleeping. So what does that mean? Like during the sleeping time, how do we define that? I think that's something to think about too.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it's very subjective, as any one of us who, you know, sleeps in bed with someone else, you know, like my wife, she likes lots of blankets almost year round, and I don't. I'm like, no, I'm so hot. I sleep with half out. But I want to explore. I love that you keep bringing back things to entropy, you know, and keep in mind, you guys, he is, you know, a sustainability lead at one of the largest, most powerful, I guess, architecture AE firms in the country. And here he is talking about entropy on this podcast over and over and over. I love it. And in the context of entropy, though, like thermal blandness, you know, this 75-50, that's low entropy. And so we really want like a little more entropy, right? Or am I misinterpreting that? It could be.
Yeah, I think we can create a demand-based environment to provide exactly what people need at certain time of the day, right? So it's I think it's happening like that. Like we used to have a uniform white noise background. Now we have equipment that the white noise will change according to the dBA level. So you save some energy when you don't need that high level of white noise. So I think it's ideas like that to continue make this better. Now we got to put this under also the light of whole life carbon to understand maybe actually as HVAC engineer, let's leapfrog that and think about whole life resources or whole life entropy, right? All this dimension in this whole life. So if you can do that, you can, if usually demand-based solution, put it filter through that whole life resources framework, can tell you which device may be the minimum impact to holistic environment. You know what I want to do as engineers with all of you together to help the world is to create one number. One number representing all these dimensions. I know it's very difficult. I know it's going to be consensus based. It's going to take a long time. But what if we can do that and start, make it very simple? Okay, maybe we are not perfect. We are only 80% there. But there's so much better than today that for a common person, they do not understand what all this means. If you can give them a building and say, this building has a number of 80, it's about impact on the environment, impact on humans, everything. That would be so nice. Maybe I'm too idealistic on this, but guess what? I know in the Europe, they have started collapsing all the EPD parameters into a index. Maybe we can think about that. Guess, you know why, guys? Because we're going to still see 3 times 2 billion to 6 billion AC units coming. A lot of energy and impact on the AC world that we as HVAC engineers, we are shouldering this for humanity. We got to create a number. Not only engineers can understand, but humanity can understand that. Then we advocate a different future when they can understand what we are talking about. By the way, entropy, once you take it out of the context of normal engineers, you're going to have a hard time trying to make the kids, you know, the people that are not associated with industry to understand what the heck are we talking about here?
Yeah. Well, I don't even know where to begin to honor all what you just said. I would, if you guys are listening on a podcast player, hit rewind a couple times and hear it again. But this is live. I mean, just creating one number that humanity can understand, your concern is profound. Like, and yes, I'm nodding and smiling. Your concern that you're being too idealistic, bring it. Like, we need a lot of idealism. We need a lot of optimism. We need a lot of, we need as much as we can to get through the disheartenment that I think is bombarding us right now.
Yeah.
I love that you have, please.
I want to echo on what you said. I think you're right. I think the impact of HVAC in our future is very big. We need bold engineers that will be not afraid to voice out big ideas to change humanity.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean, with a lot of humility, I'll tell you that you and I have spoken, and this podcast is really touching the theme over and over of engineering and science and physics is poised to deliver a wholly different and superior quality of life to the world if only the world would ask. And so, yes, I mean, I'm really deep in, there's so much I can say, I won't go into it deeper, but we're really working on that issue. It's as though humanity is saying, oh, I'm hungry, I'm so hungry. And we know food exists,
yeah.
But we can't get them to map their hunger to eating the food.
Yeah, and I think part of that has to do, it's just like the book, The Love Languages, some of you might have read it. When we speak, we got to speak their love language, not our own love language that we want.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, beautiful. I'm actually reading Houston Smith's The World's Religions right now, and I'm reading the last chapter. It's fantastic. And he talks about, you know, the divine coming to various cultures and various peoples at different times, speaking that language, speaking a language they would understand. And then here we are today arguing over, you know, which language was correct. And but I just love this idea of collapsing it all into one number. Frankly, yes, my brain lights up with like warning lights, and seeking consensus would be one. It's multivariate. You're going to have to put in some scaling factors to get to that. But I do agree that we can get to a place where we could say, higher is better, this one's higher, with lots of caveats. But generally speaking, those caveats have been well considered by thoughtful people. I want to bring you back to something, and we're getting toward the end here. But, you know, we've touched a lot on this idea of thinking in terms of entropy. And I think that's, as you actually, frankly, you brought up the topic of entropy. And then just now you basically said, but we got to be careful because it might not resonate with the majority of the people. But you also brought it up in the context of we've decided we want to live in these glass boxes, right? And most people might think, oh, he means like, my house looks like the Apple store in the mall or something. And that's what he means by glass box. I think what you're referring to are these glass skyscrapers that populate our downtown. Or please, what are you referring to about these glass boxes?
I think in general, just the human environment of having this apparently connected to outdoor spaces through the glass, but in reality it's not. So that's kind of the context I'm thinking. Skyscrapers is certainly one of them. And no, by the way, we do some of the tallest skyscrapers in the world.
And you personally have worked on them.
I personally work on many of them. That has the, and we are still understanding the whole life carbon of, if you are tall building designers, you are probably in that conversation of what is the whole life carbon of tall buildings. Now, we will be doing that in the ESRAE winter meeting. One of my discussion will be that we start quantifying the whole life carbon of a tall building compared to shorter buildings and see whether they are, you know, how do they perform. There are many discussions about maybe the density and height of this earth doesn't need to be, you know, 300 meter tower everywhere, more along the density of Paris.
Yeah.
So that seems to be one of the discussion where this is going. But we are the engineers who can provide the evidence rather than a hypothetical discussion on, you know, whether that is, I just feel that is right. Show me the numbers. So part of that is we start looking at the whole life carbon of tall buildings and start understand them. Remember, once you're a tall building, right, if you are above 200 meter tall, in the entire history of humanity, there's only one building besides the World Trade Centers that are intentionally taken down, in this case, for development purpose, only one building. So while the whole life carbon, whole life cycle of most buildings is about 60 years, 50 years, tall buildings, whole life cycle can be very different once you are taller than 200 meters. So it could very well be 100 years and beyond, because so far we have not seen one building. Well, we have not seen more than one building got taken down. And that one building is in New York City. It's one of our company's buildings that got taken down and redeveloped because it's in New York City. So we should start think about, if you are, you know, looking at that, start think about how's the tall buildings, how do they work differently than low rise and in their whole life carbon? And in terms of not just of their whole life carbon, their whole life resources impact.
Yeah. And thinking about your one number, and actually I want to come back to New York in a minute. Thinking about your one number, we're talking about whole life carbon of the building. And I want that one number to be something about the carbon intensity of the building divided by the whole life health or the whole life joy or the whole, you know, quality of life of the people in it, right? Because you want to maximize that number. You want to say, yes, we're investing carbon in this building. Of course we are. And we want to maximize human well-being with it. Something like that. But then that's even harder, right? Because now you got to quantify quality of life.
No, I think if those dimensions are not aligned together, right? If they are not aligned together, then having these two dimensions is fun. So those are the exact conversation engineers should have to start a new dialogue, a different dialogue, a dialogue that will impact humanity in a bigger way. Last year, I was invited to the White House to talk about the White House definition on zero emissions building. Then I realized, you know what? Engineers today are different than yesterday. We are put in a position that got the mass media attention on what we want to say. So let's all work together to make sure we work together to develop this message and be bold and have a message that is understandable from the other people beyond engineers, and a message that can truly impact the world for more sustainable and healthy tomorrow.
You just stopped my mind. I'm wondering if we should stop right there.
Oh, it's up to you. I wasn't intend to do that, but
let's keep going a few more moments. But that was really, you know, boom. That was like the money shot for ending. That was a mic drop moment, as they say. You're just supposed to drop the mic. But just a quick shameless plug. We interviewed a professor from University of Pennsylvania, Bill Bram, and one of his PhD students, about exactly the question you brought up, like how tall should a building be in a given city with given infrastructure and given distribution and population density. And it wasn't, 30, 40 stories. It was something like 6-7 stories, as you say, like Paris, meaning like the elevator uses so much energy to get you up there. At some point it's diminishing returns. And I'm curious, this is purely like out of the blue, just a question for you, like, why is it that we choose to build such giant condos downtown and live in them? I mean, Austin, Texas is filled with them now, right? Do you have any idea of the psychology of living that densely? Why we consider it a superior experience? Random question. I apologize if it's...
Oh, yeah. I mean, so when you look at human history, right, you have the Tower of Babel.
Oh, yeah.
And then you look further down the line, you have the Easter Islanders. They're trying to build something bigger, stronger, taller than humans. And then you have different pyramids around the world. In North America, you have the mounds that almost like a pyramid with the head chopped off. And, you know, and then you look at from the Roman Empire's infrastructure, they built until they almost bankrupt the empire, right? Because, and then you look at India, the Taj Mahal is also similar. The king, in order to show the love for the wife, built this amazing tomb for her that almost bankrupt the country. So what are they thinking?
I don't know.
So I think there's this idea of trying to reach out to something beyond the mundane human things can do. You know, this elevate human into a higher level by showing this masterpiece and this kind of very different infrastructure. So that seems to be, you know, since the dawn of time, we humans have always this, call it what you may, this kind of emotion to try to come up with something that is more permanent, bigger, beyond the lifetime. Kind of, it reminds me of King Gilgamesh in the Mesopotamia.
Yeah.
And he was lamenting that nature can live forever, but his life will get cut short. So the way he deal with it is chop down all the trees, and then you see a generation of people and civilization coming to chop down the trees to build something bigger, better, stronger, taller. And now we see that chopping down all the trees may not be the best way to create better air, better food, and better world for us. There's the study indicate by chopping down the trees, we release more nitrogen into the air, decrease the amount of you know, the diversity in bacteria in many of the urban environments. So something to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just going to take one more diversion off to the side. You mentioned, you know, this idea of reaching for something, humanity wanting to attest to its love and its depth of feeling, and reaching for maybe the divine or the more, you know, the sense of power in the world. So I read this interesting book on the second law, which is, you know, where entropy comes from. And it argued, so first of all, it was talking about humans' attempts to achieve absolute zero in a lab, right? So first you cool something down and you get the cryocoolers and you've gotten most of the electrons not vibrating very much, or, you know, the molecules definitely aren't vibrating, but now you have like the subatomic particles vibrating. And so you bring like the counter vibrating subatomic particle to try to even, you know, get this nuclear resonance down as much as possible. And the thing that really got me in the book was this idea, like, if there is a superior intelligence in the universe and it's searching for other intelligence, it won't be able to measure the height of our buildings, the size of our pyramids, but it possibly could say, something's going on here. There's this material that's very close to absolute zero, which never happens randomly. So it must be very intelligent to make that happen.
You know, to that note, I think, you know, when it comes to think about entropy, oftentimes we human is kind of along this idea of bigger, better. We want to build something beyond da 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 da. And then we try to use technology to kind of take care of things, right? The funny thing is, no matter you look at Buddhism, the Chinese word peace, and the Christianity, the Muslim, the faith of Islam, and also the faith of Judaism, the idea of Garden of Eden, all this description and culture always talk about this kind of the perfect peaceful world, the Garden of Eden, is actually a place where humans willing to submit themselves to learn about nature and others, rather than try to think, I'm going to do all these amazing things. Maybe one of the low entropy solutions here is really not that complicated. Since we are all came from the nature, maybe if we're willing to integrate with nature to become one, almost like the Garden of Eden idea that you can have this harmony of human and nature, that is the low entropy world that we've been trying so hard to create.
Yeah. So I think we should wrap up. I'm going to make this kind of one last comment echoing what you said. There's a phrase, I don't know where it comes from, but it's the idea of the strength of the oak versus the strength of the willow. And the strength of the oak is sort of the technology will save us, you know, brute force, glass box, thermal blandness, ego, I've got this. If my current solution doesn't, you know, solve all the problems, then my solution to the problems, my current solution will, right? That's the strength of the willow and the oak. And then the strength of the willow is saying, you know, technology might not save us, but human caring, human wisdom, human cleverness, right? This adaptability, this resilience, which is, you know, what we're talking about today together. We're engineers in the real world. People, in case you thought this was a philosophy podcast, and we're thinking deeply about, okay, what is it we need to do and what is it we need to say? Where do we need to say it such that our expertise, such that the world will avail itself of our expertise?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think technology is important. It just, we need to do a smell test to make sure, does that technology align with nature, integrate with nature, so it makes the terrestrial health and our health better versus, okay, this technology is going to help us human, but it's going to create all this other thing, entropy. And guess what? Later on, those things will come back to get us. We're not going to get away with it. There's only one world. As long as we are not able to start colonizing the other planets, so we still have to deal with this one world we are in.
Yeah, and colonizing the other planets doesn't actually solve the problem, it just exports it to somewhere else.
Well, I think your broadcast, hopefully we can help people to be bold about speaking what is right.
Yes, I agree completely. And Luke, I think we should end it there. I mean, we could go on and on. In fact, I'd be really honored to ask you back to the show. We'll find some topics to unpack together. And I really want to thank you for being here and give you the final word if you have any.
I truly believe that this is the time for us to shine. I mean, if we don't seize this moment, it's on us.
Yeah.
And it will be because we are engineers. Well, many of us are engineers, and we cannot get out of that stupid box of engineering.
Yeah. Yeah, we need to think big. What is it we're trying to do? So thank you again, Luke, and thank you all for listening. We'll talk to you next time. Yeah.